Welcome to Carnivores Don't Get Sunburn, hosted by Carrie Mann. Dive into the extraordinary journey of rediscovering optimal health through the carnivore diet. Here, we share powerful transformations from reversing chronic illnesses to achieving peak human potential. Each episode, we'll explore the real stories of those who've turned their lives around, embracing a diet that's as natural as the sun. Stay tuned as we uncover the science, the success stories, and the secrets to thriving on this ancestral diet. Plus, don't miss our exciting documentary highlights featuring a diverse range of carnivore champions. Ready to challenge the conventional? Let's get started.
All those things led to this food addiction that was so severe. Whenever we're talking about addiction, we're talking about a low baseline dopamine level, which basically means you're depressed. So it's not just that you're addicted to the food, it's you're addicted to it because you're trying to come up with any sort of dopamine, serotonin, any sort of mood regulating chemical that you can get your hands on because your brain isn't making that anymore.
The standard American diet's normalized and people walking around with all sorts of health issues is normalized.
The vast majority of the time when people get addicted to a drug, they're not taking the drug to feel high. They're only taking it just to feel normal again. Because without the drug, they have almost no dopamine activity in their brain anymore because they've destroyed their D2 receptors.
What advice do you have for someone that's thinking about starting carnivore but can't wrap their brain around it? They just can't. I have so many people that say this. I want to do it. I started, and 3 days later, I can't give up the sugar. My diet's soda, regular soda.
Quick interruption. Did you know we have an incredible membership site for you called healinghumanity.life? We have a special offer going on right now. Learn more at the link in the description. We have courses. We have expert Q&As with the good doctors. We even have a Healing Humanity Heroes Zoom call once a week, highlighting real heroes that will inspire you on a path to healing. The community is wonderful. We're going to be implementing a buddy system so you can be held accountable, recipes, all sorts of great stuff to help you on a path to healing. Learn more at the link in the description below.
Hello and welcome. Carrie here from Healing Humanity, the power of a proper human diet. And today I'm thankful, grateful, blessed to welcome Dr. Sarah Zaldivar to the channel. Dr. Sarah, how's it going?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much, Carrie, for having me.
Thank you. I really look forward to talking to you and hearing your story.
I really got into the whole nutrition space just as a means of weight loss. It started when a classmate of mine, he just said, oh yeah, because you're fat, like very casually. And I wasn't really fat, but I wasn't as skinny as the other girls in class. So that kickstarted this whole obsession and eating disorders and restricting my food intake, going on fad diets, which inevitably led to binge episodes where I would literally eat almost nothing for 3 days and then I couldn't handle it anymore. And then I would eat a whole jar of Nutella, you know, or like make tons of pancakes and dump all the chocolate. It was always chocolate. And then I went to see a dietitian, my first dietitian I saw. I was 14 years of age. Back then, actually to this day, they really haven't changed much of what they're recommending. But back then it was the food guide pyramid. Now they changed it into the MyPlate. They basically just changed the graphics, but the substance of it, that most of your calories have to come from grains and carbohydrates, is pretty much the same. So after seeing the dietitian, even our daily home cooked meals now became higher in carbs because my mom was trying to cook for us more healthfully. Right. So now on top of trying to lose weight and having those eating disorders, now on top of that, my usual eating pattern got worse because now we're eating even more pasta, more rice, more of all of those things. So that eventually led to me going up and down in my weight. And I was so much heavier. Like my last year of high school was so depressed. I attempted to commit suicide multiple times. Now, of course, it wasn't just the weight. It was so many additional things. The no, not very good communication, not a lot of support, if anything. All those things led to this food addiction that was so severe. And whenever we're talking about addiction, we're talking about a low baseline dopamine level, which basically means you're depressed. So it's not just that you're addicted to the food, it's you're addicted to it because you're trying to come up with any sort of dopamine, serotonin, any sort of mood regulating chemical that you can get your hands on, because your brain isn't making that anymore. And so, and of course, the more you consume those foods, the more you destroy whatever dopamine, serotonin, acetylcholine you already have, all of those mood regulating chemicals, you destroy them even more. So there's actual brain damage that occurs. And yeah, it was really bad when I was, I think, 17 or 18. I didn't even go to my prom. Like, I just, I don't feel good. I don't want to go out. And it started getting a little bit better once I graduated high school and I started my bachelor's. And of course, I was like, what should I study? I studied nutrition, because in my mind, there is no nutritionist that's overweight. That was my 17, 18 year old brain. In the first semester, my professor, whom I adore, I love her so much to this day, but she was massively overweight. So I remember the shock that I was like, wait a second, my whole life, my whole future is dependent on me becoming a nutritionist and finally getting rid of all of these issues that are stemming from body image, food addiction, depression. Like, but now all of this stuff isn't working in my mind anymore. So that's when I realized that just knowing, and also, of course, they were teaching us the wrong stuff, but I realized that just knowing a lot about nutrition did not translate to losing weight. But I stayed, obviously, because I needed a job, I needed a career. So, and also I was living in survival mode. So we really didn't have a lot of money. I was waiting tables at Applebee's four shifts in the night, and then going to school full time and trying to take maximum credits so that I would graduate as soon as possible. So I was really not really paying attention to why I wasn't losing weight. I was trying to count calories and eating those baked potatoes with sour cream because it's low fat, you know, it's what we're supposed to eat. But it wasn't really working. And eventually, after I finished that, I did my master's, and still living in survival mode. After I graduated with my master's, I had two options: either stay in Lebanon and barely make $2,000 a month because unemployment rates are high, wages are low, and that's before the economic collapse in 2019, which dropped the currency value by 90%. Now it's a lot worse. So, but it was still bad even then. So it was either that, or what a lot of my classmates would do, most of them, they would just go to Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia, like some Arabian country, because that's where the money was. And they would hire, they generally tend to hire Lebanese at a higher frequency because their education system is supposedly very strong. But my personality, it doesn't fit with that kind of environment. I don't like to feel restricted in anything or being told what to believe, what I could or couldn't do. Like, for me, I've always had kind of a wild spirit in a way. And I would rather do anything but be stuck, feeling stuck in a way. So really, I had no option except for doing my PhD, because your PhD is really, they pay you. People tend to think it's sure, you're going to school, you're learning, but they're actually paying you a stipend. It's kind of like a paid job. And once it clicked for me and I realized it, I was so excited. And throughout the 2 years I was doing my master's, I was also, every penny I was making, I was studying for all of the tests that you need to pass in order to get into graduate school. And I applied to four major universities. I got accepted into all four of them. Baylor University, Baylor was like the best program, but I wanted to go to Miami, so I chose the University of Miami, and then University of Florida, and then one in South Dakota. The reason why I accepted it is because it's the first time the professor, the first university who a professor there right away got back to me. Because when you get into a PhD, I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I shouldn't probably tell you all the degree details, but I wanted to guarantee a way out. And so the more universities I applied to, and you have to pay every time and you have to go through the whole process, but I wanted to guarantee a way out. And so it was the first professor from North or South Dakota that was very excited to have me. And that's why I ended up applying there, just to guarantee that I would leave Lebanon. And that's how it worked, you know. And then once I came to Miami, and then I met my hubby, who helped me buy a car. And so it started getting easier, you know. I wasn't all by myself in a country without friends, without family, without a car for the full year. In the first full year, I did not even have a car. So after that, it started getting easier, and I wasn't living in survival mode anymore. That's when I really started paying attention to, well, it's not that I'm not being disciplined, it's that this diet is the problem, right? And from there, I transitioned to keto because I was having a lot of anxiety, because the first semester, right away, they put you to start teaching with all of these University of Miami students. So here I am, 25-year-old immigrant, and they're like, here, you've got 100 students in an auditorium, teach them and answer all their questions. I was freaking out. I did not have that kind of experience just yet, that level of knowledge. So I was having a lot of anxiety. I remember walking to class and I could feel my heart beating out of my chest. It was awful. And I started doing a lot of digging. And I came across Dr. David Perlmutter's website, who talked about keto for anxiety. And that's how I really started going back into that kind of, you know, research, and tried it on myself. And after the 7 day of a ketogenic diet, the brain fog that apparently I had all my life without knowing immediately lifted. And that's how I was sold that, oh, wow, like carbohydrates really are not the solution. And yeah, that's how it started getting better. But I was still having the food addiction binges, and I would do keto treats and binge on that. And every time I would have a binge, I would get really depressed about it and I'd be crying. But the good thing is, even though I was crying about it, I would put on a podcast, or I would go to Barnes and Noble's and buy a bunch of books on the topic. So I always needed to feel that that failure wasn't for nothing, and that helped me stay sane. And that's how I discovered Dr. Stephen Gundry's book, The Plant Paradox, and then The Carnivore Diet by Sean Baker. And I watched the Joe Rogan episodes on that. Yeah. That's how I got into carnivore.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like? Culture shock, like coming from Lebanon to the United
States? Oh, no culture shock. The culture shock for me was living in Lebanon, because I was always different.
Right.
I never felt that I fit in. I always felt there was something different about me. I don't know what it is. To this day, I still feel this way, even in the United States. I think it... I've always, I guess you could say, I have a gifted brain. If I really, like, you know, not to brag or anything, but even from when I was young, the first year, when kindergarten, like the first time you go to school with kids, all the kids were crying, and I was the only one that wasn't, and everybody was so puzzled, like how well adjusted I was. And after a couple of weeks or 3 weeks of that, all the other kids calm down, and I started throwing fits and crying, and everybody was puzzled yet again, what is wrong with this girl? And when they asked me, apparently my answer was that they're not teaching us fast enough and I'm getting bored. So I think that's where it comes from, you know, and that genetic propensity. Plus the fact that my mom helped, like, always made sure that she got me all the books I wanted. So I was always a reader, an avid reader. I would read a lot of, I read fiction books. I would go through all the series of all the books up until I was like 17, 18. And then something clicked in me at 17 or 18. And I was like, why am I reading fiction? I could just watch that in a movie. And ever since then, I've never touched a fiction book. And it was all nonfiction. Even before I started my college, before the first semester, I remember going through textbooks, actual academic textbooks that are supposed to be like very boring. And I would study the whole thing. I knew the name of every single muscle before even the first day in my bachelor's degree. So I think that kind of makes me kind of struggle sometimes to fit in. Not sometimes, all the time. It's a problem that I'm working on.
Right?
Yes.
Well, it's amazing that you overcame anxiety and brain fog. That's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this too. It's do you have any idea, like, the mechanism behind that? Like, you go ketogenic and now you're no longer anxious? Because you look around in the world right now and it's like everybody is in this state of anxiety all the time.
I wouldn't say. So the ketogenic diet, the reason I was sold on it is because it lifted the brain fog and it gave me mental clarity. And I didn't realize I had brain fog before that. That's when once I felt this difference in the mental clarity, I was sold. So keto is definitely a step in the right direction. I don't think keto cured my anxiety. My anxiety was just a knowledge gap that I had to fill by teaching hundreds of classes and researching additional stuff around my material, because I will have an anxiety attack if you go put me on a stage right now and tell me you have to go over a physics lecture. I'm not prepared. I don't know all the stuff about physics that I'm supposed to know. So my anxiety was just a knowledge gap, I realized. It had nothing to do with my diet, you know? But it was the reason why I went searching for keto and searching for ways to handle anxiety.
Right.
Yeah.
The brain fog going away is a remarkable thing for so many people. I've interviewed so many carnivores, and that's kind of a consistent one with them. It's hard to describe to other people because a lot of people will say, I got a little bit of brain fog, but I don't think most people realize the extent of it because you sort of normalize it over years and years.
You don't even know it's there. It becomes your normal. It's very difficult to realize that there is something seriously off with your brain. Because you don't see it. It's so hidden, you know? You just think that this is your personality or your character or this is how you are or this is how everybody is. That's why it's so difficult to pinpoint.
Right.
But yeah, anxiety is... Nutrition plays a big role, I believe, of course, because your blood sugar, you don't have those blood sugar spikes, right? If you're eating carbs and there's a physiological reason why you're having anxiety, that's step number one, remove the carbohydrates. So your blood sugars aren't shooting up and your body releasing insulin to try and drop it back down. And as it drops down, it always drops below baseline. And that even minor drops of blood glucose below baseline is a massive trigger for hunger, appetite, and also anxiety and brain fog, right? This is how I used to be without even realizing it. When I would get hungry at 17, 18, around that time where all I ate was carbs, I needed to eat right now. I couldn't see straight. It's like, I need to eat right now, right? And so people go through life, sometimes their whole lives like that. And that's why every 2 to 3 hours, they're having a snack. And it's usually a fast sugar, fast carbohydrate, rapidly digesting form of carb to try and raise that blood sugar as quickly as possible. What raises blood sugar as quickly as possible, if you're not keto adapted, a form of carbohydrate.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes normal for people, like snacking multiple. That used to be me, snacking multiple times a day. That's one of the biggest benefits, I think, eating this way now. It's just like you said, there's not the ups and downs, so there's just like this zen, and you're not constantly thinking about eating. And the whole brain fog thing, I was thinking about this more recently. It doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Oh, you got a little bit of brain fog, but I think it's a much larger deal because I think it's the reason I think about this for myself. Before finding carnivore, I'd come home and I'd like plop down on the couch and I would do the bare minimum. And I had goals and dreams, but it's just like, oh, I just got this. You can't, it's almost like you're a little bit drunk or intoxicated. And if you think about the majority of humanity walking around like that, walking around like my former self, it's kind of scary when you think about it that way, especially because most people will go their whole lives forever, and they'll in that mild state of intoxication, never thinking with just full clarity and no brain fog.
That is so huge that, yeah, a lot of people are focused so much on the weight loss and the health aspect. They don't realize, they don't appreciate how much reduced productivity you're having. It's like 90% reduced productivity. You have a pizza and some brownies or whatever afterwards, your whole, the rest of your day is shot. There's no way you're going to feel motivated or enough focus to be able to work on anything.
Yeah. So the documentary we're working on, just real quick, we've interviewed 45 people. And each of the people, I'm like, I'm interviewing this person because they have type 2 diabetes or they have depression. They're going to overcome it with carnivore. I kind of know that going into it. But all 45 people, every single one of them, whatever their success metric was in life, making money or whatever it may be, it all goes up. And I think it's a big part of it is because that brain fog goes away and you have the ability to make better decisions. Also, you have more energy. But that was one remarkable thing about filming this documentary is I go into with these expectations and then you learn something completely differently. We have this one couple, Pastor Jimmy and Annette. They run a church in Texas and they've been doing it for 20 years. And the first year they were carnivore, the size of their congregation doubled. 1 year doing carnivore. And they're like, wow. We're on top of things so much better on carnivore. We're making better decisions. Everything they're doing. So it's like everyone we've talked to, that success metric improves. It's kind of an incredible, makes you think like, what if the whole world was eating a proper human diet? But you mentioned earlier something that I got fired up about this yesterday, the keto snacks and keto treats. I think those things are criminal. I get so mad when I see those in the, I messed up so many times on keto for years and years because of those things. And I don't know if you have any more thoughts on it, but like you look at the ingredients on some of those things, it's worse than some of the standard American diet food. It's just packed with seed oils and all sorts of garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the artificial sweeteners, they all mess up your gut microbiome, which leads to leaky gut, which is the root cause of every single chronic condition that you can think of, right? And so here's the thing. I have two types of ways that I work with my clients. Some people can do strict carnivore, they come in, they have had enough pain, enough stimulus to start and stick with it. And then other people who haven't really reached a rock bottom moment and they're struggling. Like every time they try to go strict carnivore, they keep falling off track. And so for those people, I try to get them keto adapted first. And so I allow that flexibility, especially if they don't have autoimmune disease, because if they have major symptoms, you tell them to go keto, but then that flares up their symptoms, which makes it harder to stick to any plan. They're just constantly in, look, I can't, I'm going to eat whatever because I'm just so depressed. I have all this pain. I don't have energy. So it depends. But if somebody is relatively healthy and they're struggling to dive into strict keto right off the bat, I find, and I've had those success stories where we transition them into keto and their body adapts to running on fat as opposed to carbs, and they lose a lot of weight, they build up momentum, they get excited, and they have more motivation and less cravings, and it becomes so much easier than to clean up the diet and go whole foods carnivore, you know?
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. I'm so enthusiastic about carnivore, sometimes I gotta chill out, but that's kind of the recommendation I give people too. I'm like, my wife, she's been doing carnivore for 200 or 300 days now. But she initially jumped right into carnivore and it was a big failure. It was too quick. She was vegetarian. But I told her, I'm like, you should do keto first. That's what I normally recommend people is keto first. For people that can maintain keto, I think it's awesome. But there's some people I find that just they won't advocate for carnivore at all and it's only keto. And I worry about people in that regard because I think a lot of people out there, I would say the majority of people have an addiction. And for me, keto was a million times better than a standard American diet. It got me so close, but I did keto for maybe 10 years and I just kept yo-yoing. I would lose a bunch of weight. And I felt like when I finally found carnivore, I felt like I know what I was doing wrong. I was trying to moderate my addiction with keto. I was trying to have a little bit of my carb addiction every now and then and measure it out, some nuts and some blueberries and this and that. And every time I get a little taste of that, I just go nuts and I'd start binging again for more. So I know everybody's different, but that's my only caution, I guess, for people out there. I feel like there's a lot of people that are addicted. Like when you see like Paul Saladino, for example, it's like the majority of people aren't fit like Paul Saladino working out on the beach and surfing all the time. I feel like if you look around in the world, the majority of the people are probably heavier and addicted.
And I think even Saladino would say the same thing, right? He wouldn't recommend eating like him if you have insulin resistance, leptin resistance, you still have weight to lose. That you shouldn't, it's not even up for debate. If you have excess body fat, if you have autoimmune issues, it depends. Some people can do certain other non-carnivore foods and still do well as long as there are no artificial sweeteners in there. But if I think the vast majority of our audience of the world, it's mainly overweight or even into the obesity spectrum. And they're very high levels of food addiction and insulin resistance and leptin resistance. So it's not even up for debate. Carbs right. have to go for a very long time. And for some of them, maybe for a long, forever.
Well, that's why it's good. There's people like you out there helping people. Cause I get a lot of people on my YouTube channel and you wouldn't believe the number of times I've heard people say, I'm going to do that Paul Saladino version. I'm like,
They always come back though to strict carnivore.
Yeah, before. But I feel so bad for them because it's like they go down that road and some of them will go down it for months. And some of these people have serious mm-hmm. issues like type 2 diabetes. Maybe you're going to lose a limb or something or horrible wow. depression. And it's just like, education and spreading awareness, I guess, for some people. But it's pretty awesome what you're doing to help people. What is it like for you when someone comes to you and they're desperate or hopeless and you're able to put them on a path to healing?
I mean, I love it. Obviously, I feel like sometimes I take it for granted because I'm lucky enough to have stumbled across this body of knowledge, which is so powerful and so effective. And I just know that they're going to be successful. So I should be better at celebrating the wins. But we have so many more wins as compared to the way that I used to practice traditional dietetics, where earliest clients that I would see, I would give them what they would teach us and they wouldn't lose weight. And I would question them if they really follow the diet. I couldn't believe that there's no way you wouldn't lose weight. I gave you a caloric deficit. So there's something there that you're not telling me. And so, yeah, if I go back to the way that I used to practice versus now, it makes me very, very fulfilled. It's it's really a line of work where you're transforming lives. 99% of the time we're talking mindset, we're talking psychology. It's not so much about, because the diet stuff is easy, what to eat, what not to eat, and how to work out. It's the ability to sustain that, to be compliant that has, and so this is where we open up the whole topics about setting boundaries, people pleasing, what motivates you, do you like your job, do you hate your job, why aren't you pursuing your passion? What, there are so many blocks that keep people kind of living in this, they're living but they're not really living, but they convince themselves that it's okay, and because it's, they don't know the way out without a lot of pain. And so this is kind of the bulk of the work that I do. My aunt is a psychologist, and she just finished her master's in her 60s. She went back to school. She did her bachelor's and her master's. So proud of her. And every time we talk, she's like, wow, like all you're a therapist, basically. I was like, yeah, I know. It's all psychology. It's all about the mind. But I don't talk so much about that because that's not what people want to hear. People just want the YouTube video that starts with fastest weight loss. So I give them that. It's okay. But then right. once we start working together, they understand what's been keeping them stuck in the past,
Right.
Yeah.
It's so interesting what you're saying about just seeing all of the incredible healing and it kind of becomes normal for you. I've been noticing that too, where I'll have people come on and they're like, I lost 100 pounds on carnivore. It's like, yeah. Heard
another day, another success.
I heard that 100 times now. And then you feel bad because you think 100 pounds. Someone on my channel said this and I keep using it. I'm like, that's 10 pound bowling balls. This person is no longer carrying around. That's incredible. Wow. But you hear it so often now. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of an annoying part of the human brain where we normalize the good and we normalize the bad, like the standard American diet's normalized and people walking around with all sorts of health issues is normalized. It's kind of an annoying thing that we humans do. But on the psychology front, that's one thing. I have a lot of new carnivores that come to my channel and a lot of them struggle. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think a lot of it's psychological as well. But what advice do you have for someone that's thinking about starting carnivore, but they can't wrap their brain around it, or they can't get over, they just can't. I have so many people that say this: I want to do it, I started, and 3 days later, I can't give up the sugar. I got to have my diet soda, my regular soda, whatever.
Mm-hmm. One of my most viewed YouTube videos has to do with sugar withdrawal symptoms, what to expect once you're cutting out the sugars and the carbohydrates. And you can see the comments, and some people have very severe, I mean, I would consider myself to have had also severe reactions initially, but that was such a long time ago that I forgot about it. But yeah, it was very difficult for me every time I would slip up and go back to quitting carbs and addictive foods. It was really hard. I think this is really the bulk of what I do. The bulk of what I do, and that was the topic of my dissertation too, how to raise baseline dopamine, how to repair the brain damage, the destruction of the dopamine centers in the brain, so that you can go back to having a healthy functioning brain that doesn't have cravings, low motivation, all that kind of stuff. So it really boils down to expecting the symptoms, understanding that you're not losing your mind in the first few days, sometimes the first week. You're not losing your mind. Those are symptoms of food addiction withdrawal. You're detoxing all of those addictive foods and you're detoxing the carbohydrates. Knowing what they are is really important, but more importantly than that is understanding how to raise your baseline dopamine levels so that you don't necessarily have to go through that. So when clients work with me, especially if they come from a standard American diet or eating carbs, I don't just right away remove everything. For most people, I find what works a lot better is detoxing them slowly. You can't go from 500, 600 grams of carbohydrates to zero without having a crisis where you feel like your brain just can't handle that. So what I like to do is drop it by 100, 150 grams a day. So let's say they start off with 500 grams of carbs normally in their usual dietary pattern. It's like, okay. This is especially if motivation is not super high, because some clients are kind of like forced to come see me. Their husbands are like, over here, go see her. So that's where I detox them slowly, which builds up their intrinsic motivation as they start seeing the success. If motivation is high, that's actually a form of a massive dopamine when you say, that's it, I'm going all in, and you will not go through the withdrawal symptoms as severely. So that's another pathway. But if people are listening to us right now and they still don't have that moment where it's like, that's it, I'm going to change my diet, what I would suggest is just put a goal that's not the loftiest goal in the world, but that goal is going to be releasing dopamine once you achieve it enough to motivate you to set a bigger goal. And the way that I would go about it is, okay, you start off with 500 grams of carbohydrates normally. Let's cut that down to 350 the next day. The day after that, let's drop it to 200 grams. The day after that, let's drop it to 50 or maybe 100 grams. And then we drop it to 50 and then we can go to zero. So you have a few days where you're actually losing weight, right? Because let's say you have 400 or you weigh 300 pounds. If you go from 500 grams a day to 2-3 days down to, let's say, 50 grams, you're dropped a lot of weight and a lot of inflammation, and you've built up momentum and you've released a lot of dopamine every single morning when you weigh yourself and you see that you've dropped 2 pounds, 3 pounds, 4 pounds. I have a client, he literally, the first 150 pounds he dropped them by 25 pounds a month without even exercising, because he couldn't, he had knee joint issues. So he was dropping 25 pounds per month. That's how we were able to drop him 150 pounds that way, wow. Right? So I know, but it feels good. It doesn't feel like you're driving with the brakes on. It feels great because the wins are coming every day. So that would be my strategy. And then once you drop the carbs to zero, you might still be doing addictive foods. You might still be doing keto treats, protein bars, keto cheesecake, keto, every single addictive food you can think of, they've made it into a keto version.
Right.
So now the next step for the next week is decrease the frequency and the calories that are coming from those addictive foods. And so in like a week or two, you've cleaned up the diet, you've eliminated addictive foods, you've eliminated the carbohydrates, and you did not have to feel that your brain's about to explode because you're faced with all of the withdrawal symptoms that are so intense and they all come at once. But that's not enough, because the initial spark and the initial motivation at some point is going to, you're going to get used to it. And so now if we still have a low baseline dopamine level that we're not attacking and raising up, you're still going to have cravings on the, usually by the second week or third week is when most people start to get used to, they start to get a little too comfortable, especially if they have a long way to go. And so this is where raising baseline dopamine levels are so important. I don't know if you've watched some of my videos or if you've come across this notion, basically, what is food addiction? Any kind of addiction. Every time you consume a drug, your brain releases a ton of dopamine all at once. Supra physiological levels of dopamine, more than what nature intended. This is similar to doing lines of coke, any kind of drug. What does cocaine do? It stimulates the brain and the body. You want to move a lot. Your appetite is suppressed. You don't even want to sleep. So you could waste away and you can burn yourself to the ground and you could die from nonstop stimulation. There was a case of this kid that was playing a lot of video games for 2 days in a row, wouldn't use the bathroom, wouldn't eat. He died.
Oh my goodness.
There are certain video games that are so powerfully engineered to be as addictive as hard drugs. So your brain is actually trying to protect you from nonstop stimulation. Every time you consume a drug, it doesn't know for how long the stimulation is going to last. And it wants to protect you from killing yourself. So what does it do? There are receptors in your brain for dopamine. So for dopamine to do its job, it's not just about releasing dopamine. Dopamine actually has to bind to its receptor called a D2 receptor. We have multiple receptors for dopamine. They're all important, but the one that's most important is D2. So you have receptor D1, D2, D3, D4, D5. Receptor D2 is the one that is the most powerfully implicated in addiction and the most researched when it comes to addiction. You release dopamine, it attaches to the D2 receptor. It's like a lock and key situation. And it allows you to feel the pleasurable effect of dopamine. You feel high, you feel motivated, you have mental clarity, you're sharp, your memory is strong, you're happy. All the things, all the good things that we ascribe to dopamine. But that only happens when dopamine attaches to D2 receptor. So when you're taking drugs, your brain, including a muffin or a pizza, that's a form of a drug. Whether it's a food drug or whether it's an actual hard drug, it does not matter. The brain chemistry is the same. You're releasing a lot of dopamine. Your brain freaks out and it's trying to protect you from killing yourself. So what does it do? It starts to destroy the amount of D2 receptors that you have on the cell surface of your brain, right? And so when dopamine is getting released from a brain cell and it's trying to attach to its receptor on the cell surface of an adjacent brain cell, it doesn't find enough D2 receptors now to attach to. And so this is why over time you build tolerance to a drug and you start increasing the dosage of the drug, because over time you're destroying the amount of D2 receptors. So you're taking the drug, you're still feeling miserable. And so you think, well, maybe if I take more of the drug. And to a certain extent that works, because also the frequency with which you stimulate the D2 receptors also increases dopamine levels and the activity of dopamine levels. So building tolerance works to a certain extent, because even though you're left, let's say, with just two D2 receptors as opposed to having trillions, if you're left with just two D2 receptors, if you increase the dose of the drug, you start to stimulate those remaining D2 receptors with higher frequency, and that kind of compensates a little bit and increases the activity of dopamine to a certain extent until those D2 receptors also get destroyed. And so this is why the vast majority of the time when people get addicted to a drug, they're not taking the drug to feel high. They're only taking it just to feel normal again, because without the drug, they have almost no dopamine activity in their brain anymore because they've destroyed their D2 receptors. And so if you start off with a baseline mood and motivation level that's high, which is equivalent to a high amount of D2 receptors, over the course of an addiction, it starts to drop and drop and drop and drop and drop until you are left with very low D2 receptor numbers. In other words, you're left with a very low baseline dopamine level. And this is why an addict's brain is a depressed brain. It's not a happy brain. And so taking the drug is not, it's no, most of the time is not for fun. It's just to feel normal again.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
I've never heard it described like that before. I feel like on carnivore, for the first time, I don't have any addictions anymore. Although I really like ribeye and steak, but what's going on with my dopamine now? Is it just zanned out? Or
the moment you quit a drug, it takes approximately 2 years for your brain chemistry to repair itself and to go back to normal. What I do with my clients is I try to bridge that gap. I don't want them to spend 2 years in a vulnerable state, which is why addiction rehab programs have a success rate of less than 5%, because they're not fixing that low baseline dopamine fast enough, right? And so especially if somebody was admitted into a rehab protocol against their wishes, they don't have that intrinsic motivation, like, that's it, I'm going to be sober now. If they don't have enough of a conviction themselves, and they're just trying to get sober halfway, you know, like half-assing it in a way, this is where it's really important to speed up the repair of the D2 receptor numbers and speed up the increase in baseline dopamine. And you can do that via multiple pathways. I use two main ways: exercise. The faster you can run and the heavier weights you can lift, the greater the number of D2 receptor regeneration you get. And so the faster you raise your baseline dopamine, and the great thing about it is there is no limit. So if you train your body to be able to run 5 miles a day, you go from a baseline dopamine here to the equivalent of 5 miles a day, which so goes up a little bit. But then you might decide, I want an even higher baseline dopamine, because dopamine also is involved with creativity. Maybe you want to be more creative, create more documentaries at a faster pace. Maybe you want to increase your learning rate at a faster pace. All those things have to do with baseline dopamine levels. So you might decide, you know what? I can run 5 miles easily now. I'm getting really fast. It feels easy for me. Let me raise my baseline dopamine a little bit higher. So you decide to get faster and start being able to run even more. So now you're running 10 miles a day. Now you've doubled your creativity. You've doubled your motivation levels. You've doubled your memory capacity. And you've doubled the rate at which you can learn. All those things have to do with raising your baseline dopamine. What happens if you take it up to 15 miles a day, 20 miles a day? And I'm not just saying like, take all day long. You need to get faster too, so that, you know, marathon runners, elite marathon runners can sustain a speed of 12 to 13 miles per hour for 2 hours straight. This is how they win the marathons, right? And so this has been done by millions of people. The top speed ever recorded by any runner is Usain Bolt. I think he reached a top speed. Was it like 20? I think it was 27 miles per hour, or maybe either 23 or 27, one of those miles per hour. Yeah, but in sprints, not like sustained. But marathon runners can sustain a speed of 12 to 13 miles per hour. And so that's the beauty of using exercise to raise your baseline dopamine. It's not just about curing yourself of addictions and distractions. It's all the other things, the creativity, the learning, the mental clarity, all those things go up along with it. Now, a lot of my clients come to me because maybe they have arthritis. They can't work out like that. So we can't use that methodology, at least not in the beginning, until they have healing happening. So there's another very powerful way that can also do the same thing, and that is visualization techniques. And I've introduced two new terms in my guide. The one where I break down my methodology, it's in the guide, Monster Mindset Guide. And the exercise component that I was telling you about is all outlined in my guide, Dopamine Brain.
Quick interruption. Thank you so much for watching. If you're interested in learning more about our documentary, Healing Humanity, The Power of a Proper Human Diet, or supporting it, please visit donate.healinghumanity.movie. Our goal is to reach millions of people that are hopeless right now, and sharing the examples of real people over the course of 1 year that are undertaking a proper human diet to overcome obesity, type 2 diabetes, depression, anxiety, fertility issues. We couldn't do it without you. We thank you so much. We are also selling these shirts, Healing Humanity, The Power of a Proper Human Diet. Every penny we get from those goes towards the documentary. And last, we have memberships. If you click the little join button, it's best to do it on desktop. Under any one of my YouTube videos, you can join and become a member. We have hundreds of members right now. We do members-only videos. We do members-only behind the scenes. You can email me as a member and I'll answer you. And every penny from that goes to support the documentary. And the last thing is, we have these Redmond's portable salt shakers. These things are awesome. You can get the best salt. You can take it with you. We sell these on the website along with our water bottles and cutting boards, and every penny from all of those goes 100% towards supporting the documentary. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which is completely free. All of these links are in the description below. Thank you so much for your support. Now back to today's video.
So in the Monster Mindset Guide, I go over how visualization can also raise baseline dopamine. As a matter of fact, instantly, the moment you sit down to do a visualization session, you're going to increase dopamine release in your brain by 65%. So it's instantly addicting, which is great, because we want to shift our addictions from unhealthy addictions to things that are releasing dopamine, but that are actually growing us as opposed to taking away from us. And the beautiful thing with visualization is that over time, as you get better and better and better at visualization, it also raises your baseline dopamine, not just the instantaneous dopamine release.
That's really cool. It's so interesting too, because, well, myself personally, but a lot of people I've talked to, I was never a fan of exercising, but it wasn't until I found healing through carnivore, I found like, I want to. I just went to the gym before this. It's something I never would have done my whole life before, but yeah, it's probably feeding into all of that. I love that you're talking so much about addiction, because I think it's such a huge part of the problem for people. I just did a video not too long ago, and I guess the basis of the video was, hey, on carnivore, I finally realized that I was trying to moderate an addiction my entire life, and that's why I yo-yo dieted and went up and down and up and down. And out of all the videos I've ever done, I have never had so many comments from people that are like, whoa, like, I didn't realize I was addicted. Yeah. I had no idea that this was an addiction. I just thought I was eating food. Like, we're humans, we have to eat. Do you find that with people you work with, that they're not even aware that they're necessarily addicted?
I think most people aren't aware. And even if now we've come to an age where most people would agree that food can be addictive, but I think they agree to it on a surface level, but it hasn't really clicked for them. Right? Because a major stage in addiction is denial. It's like, yeah, but not really. I'm not really addicted.
Right.
You know, I think it's really important also to stress that addiction is just a very strong habit, a very, very deep, it's a very well learned cycle in your brain and a very strong habit. So a lot of people shy away from being aware of their addiction because they believe that if they accept that they are addicts, then there is no hope for them. Because for decades, we've been fed the message that don't touch drugs, because if you touch them and you become addicted, that's it for you. There is no way out, you know? Right. And so when you say the word addiction, the only thing that people see is this homeless person under a bridge that has zero hope. And that's just not true. There are millions of people that get sober every day. And not only do they go on to have great lives, they actually have more successful lives because of the things they had to learn so that they wouldn't be an addict anymore, right? Yeah. And I think that's the taboo and the stigma. And I've learned not to use the word addiction in my YouTube titles because of that.
Yeah. There's also, I think, a shame with it, which in my opinion, there shouldn't be any shame, because I guess if it was like cocaine or another drug that I chose to take, but it's like with food, my parents gave me this food. I gave it to my kids. We didn't know any better. And the food is just, it is ridiculous how they pay people millions and millions of dollars to engineer this food to be even more and more addictive. Of course, we're all addicted. There should literally be no shame at all. People should be angry if anything. Like,
right.
We get hooked on this stuff.
You know what it is too? We all forgot the first time we were given sugar and how it changed our state. And that's why we don't register. We've always felt this way. So if you take a new drug for the first time and you see this massive shift in your physiology, it's like, wow, this is a drug. But if all your life you've been given sugar, as a kid, you don't remember what it did to your brain, that first hit that you got. You actually ended up spending the rest of your life just consuming it just to make you feel normal again, because you're in that withdrawal stage the rest of your life. You're just eating it to stimulate whatever D2 receptors you have left in your brain.
Yeah. Wow. Good stuff. I'm so glad you're talking about this, because I think this is a huge area. I know on my channel, there's so many people that need more help with this. Where can people find out more about what you're doing? And maybe if they want to work with you, is that an option? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, totally. I do offer one-on-one coaching. It's on drsarahzaldivar.com/coaching. And the guides are on drsarahzaldivar.com/shop. And that's where you can find the dopamine brain guide that teaches you the exercise protocol, because not any kind of exercise. It has to be a specific one that's outside your comfort zone, because you have to go through a little bit of discomfort, because the pain or the discomfort is the trigger to increase the number of D2 receptors in one's brain. If you get used to that new type of exercise, it means you're no longer progressing and raising your D2 receptors even more. Because dopamine is an anesthetic. You have to give it a strong enough reason for your brain to waste its energy and resources to create more dopamine machinery and more D2 receptors. And that reasoning that you're giving your brain is in the form of a little bit of discomfort. So that exercise protocol is in dopamine brain. The visualization techniques, if you cannot work out, are in monster mindset. But yeah, you can find the guides on my website. And also, I will send you a free copy of a 30-day carnivore diet challenge guide if you sign up to my newsletter. So people can also head on over to drsarahzaldivar.com/newsletter. And within 24 hours, you will receive an email from me with a free guide, the 30-day carnivore challenge guide, which is close to 200 pages that goes over, you know, all the stuff that people need to know about a carnivore diet.
Nice. That is awesome. I will have links in the description below for all of that and for Dr. Sarah's YouTube page as well. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you, Carrie. I am so proud of the work that you're doing. It really is so fulfilling to see so many people coming into the space and sharing their transformational journeys and having the courage to create a documentary that is so not mainstream, and, you know, having all of this passion and this drive for it. You're doing amazing work that is very much needed. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. It was great talking with you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.